Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Friday. It's July 16th. 61 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Cesar Carnejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Today we continue to see a beautiful kind of day, starting off a little bit of cloud cover. But other than that, we do see plenty of sunshine. Then we start to see the return of some scattered showers. That's something to keep in mind if you're looking to go outdoors. We can expect to see a high of 86 for us and some slightly breezy winds. Tonight, we'll see that the scattered thunderstorms and showers start to die out towards the evening time. We then become partly cloudy, low of 60 for us. Saturday, more isolated thunderstorm activity possible, mostly for the higher elevations. And we can expect to see mostly sunny skies, if not downright sunny. High of 87 for us, so great time to still be outdoors. Just plan ahead in case of anything. Saturday night, we see those thunderstorm activity die out. Mostly clear skies. 62 is going to be our low. Sunday is going to be a day to be outside. We expect to see much drier conditions. Sunny, plenty of sunshine. Once again, we'll have a high of 90. And by the time we get to Sunday night, we see the return of some moisture once again. Cloud cover starts to infiltrate for us. It's low 64. Monday, we expect to see that monsoonal moisture makes its way again as we have mostly sunny skies with an afternoon sun chance of shower activity for us. We'll have a high of 91. Monday night, we could expect to see some showers lingering over us, but they start to die out into the overnight hours. We'll have a low of 64. Tuesday, we'll see mostly sunny skies, chance of showers, but temperatures actually drop a bit. We'll see a high of 86 for us. Going into Tuesday night, we expect to see that we'll see those thunderstorm chances slowly start to taper down as we go into the evening. Mostly cloudy skies, and we'll see a low around 64. Wednesday, again, we just are on repeat monsoon season. We have the chance of afternoon thunderstorms and showers with mostly sunny skies towards the early part of the day, a high of 86. And then again, repeat of Tuesday night out for Wednesday night, where we see mostly cloudy skies, lessening chances of thunderstorms, a low of 63. And Thursday, we can expect to see, once again, hello monsoon season. Thunderstorms possible for us in the afternoon. We'll see some mostly sunny skies and a high of 86. From the ABC4 Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you, Leslie.
All right, have a great weekend. Thanks, Cesar. In the studio with me now, I've got Laura Smith with Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Friday, everybody.
So what have we got out there? Dry, dusty trails, yeah?
Yep, dry, dusty, but we do have a couple of things we can talk about today. First off, there's going to be parking enforcement on the Guardsman Road up near the Bloods Lake and the Bonanza Flat Trail heads. They're going to start enforcing, so no parking on the Guard Road. And let's see, what else have we got? Oh, yeah, tomorrow is the last day to run the Jupiter Peak Steeplechase. It was virtual race again this year. If you want to get out and support Mountain Trails with that fundraiser, go ahead, knock yourself out. It's 8 miles up, 8 miles down. So great, great way to spend an afternoon on the trails. We finished, speaking of Bonanza Flat area, we just finished a hand-cut trail up at, goes from Lake Lackawaxen up to the saddle between 10420 and Clayton's Peak. So it used to be kind of like a skid for life type of trail. Now you can actually walk down the trail. So get out there. It's a high elevation, nice and cool. Dogs are allowed up in that neck of the woods. We'd encourage you to keep them leashed because there are a lot of animals, wildlife moving around up there. And then also, I'm just kind of wrap it up. We've got two projects. One is over near the Black Forest between the 9K Trail and the Mid-Mountain Trails. We're doing a connector trail. It's a flow trail. And they're doing the corridor clearing right now, so just stay clear. You're going to hear machinery, chainsaws. It's not a safe place to be right now. Same goes for above town, the Mother Urban Trail. It's kind of in the Sweeney's area. If you hear chainsaws or whatnot, just, you know, maybe go a different direction. You don't want a tree to fall on you, although we are very careful about safety up there. So, yeah, that's about it. Have a nice, cool weekend.
Okay, well, I don't know that Mountain Trails was involved, but Park City Municipal running their transit to trails now with shuttles up to Bonanza Flat.
Yeah, that's to help with the parking congestion. So yeah, they open it this weekend at the Munchkin lot. So you can kind of behind where Anaya's used to be. There's a parking lot back there. You can reserve a shuttle and get yourself up to the trails up high and not have to drive or hassle with parking. So pretty slick deal, and it is free. So thank you to Utah Open Lands and Park City Municipal for arranging that.
Okay. 6 bikes max per trip. Do we have any idea how often that they're going to be doing this?
There's a schedule. If you go to utahopenlands.org, their website has a schedule. It's a little complex to discuss on the radio, but you can look at it. It makes perfect sense.
Okay. And again, people are being asked to call, text, or email to reserve a seat. The number I have is 801-808-1367. And again, utahmountainshuttle.com/transit-to-trails is the number to call.
Yeah, it's up and running.
See how it works.
Yeah,
okay,
great.
Get an update on it. Thanks. Right.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:12. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, stay tuned. Coming up in just a minute here, we'll be talking with board member with High Valley Transit, Joe Spink, with an update on how the transit service is doing its first month of service. Park City Council member Max Dorelny with a recap of last night's long city council meeting. And finally, Park City resident and chairman of Better Boundaries, Jeff Wright, will be introducing their new executive director, a familiar name around here, Katie Wright. They'll have an update on the redistricting process taking place. The High Valley Transit Service got a soft start with its microtransit service in mid-June. On July 1st, the county-run transit service taking over operations in the Snyderville Basin as well as the express bus to Camas. On the phone with a look at how they're doing, I have board member Joe Spink. Good morning, Joe.
Hey, good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well. And I guess I should be saying that you were a board member of High Valley Transit. You have resigned from the board?
Yeah, I am still serving through the end of August, but I did tender my resignation. It's been an interesting 16 months, as most of us can attest to, and long-range plans change, and life happens. So after September 1st, I will no longer meet the criteria, and I can't be a board member. So it has been a great experience. I have a lot of respect for Summit County staff and High Valley Transit staff, and Kim Carson and the rest of the board members have been an absolute pleasure to work with. And quite frankly, they've taught me a lot, and they've lit a spark. And I think wherever we end up, I will reengage in public again. So it's been a great experience so far. Very proud of this group and what we've been able to accomplish in the past 7 months.
Okay, so you're basically moving out of the district, so can no longer serve as a board member, is that it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, let's get an update on microtransit. Again, that kind of kicked off in mid-June and seems to be reporting very strong numbers. Do you have any of those?
Yeah, I do. Before I start, we have a fantastic data team, and all of the numbers are updated weekly on the website. So if any of the listeners are interested, please go to our website where you can see the weekly reports. So we think it's going really well. The data on ridership and driver utilization indicates that people are adopting and using our system. So far with Micro, through the end of last week, we've had 10,350 passengers in the Black Siennas. We've got 4,000 people have set up accounts with Micro or with High Valley Transit. And we're seeing utilization rates that exceed our expectations and even the guidance that we received from our partner VIA. Our target was 2.5 passengers per net driver hour, hopefully that makes sense. VIA's target for us was 3.0 to be considered a success, and we're averaging about 3.6 passengers per net driver hour. So we're really, I think we're really ahead of where we thought we would be at this point in time.
Yeah.
You know, the first week of July, that July 4th weekend, was a very busy weekend for our service, and we had almost 3,000 passengers in micro that week, over 400 a day. And I think the best stat for us is that 37% of the rides had at least two people in the micro. So we are we're ahead of schedule as far as utilization. It's pretty cool.
Have you had a chance to ride this?
I have not yet, but that will change shortly for some interesting personal reasons and children and cars. But yes, I'm going to start to use it. So
yeah, we've certainly heard a lot of anecdotal stories about microtransit, and of course some people are just saying, God, it's the best thing ever. And then of course the most egregious, I suppose, on the Bitch and Complain Facebook page, people saying, you know, they've ridden the bus for years and now cannot rely on the new system to get them to work or a dentist appointment in time. And I guess it's like, if we want people to use it, how do we make this reliable and functional and guarantee that they can get to where they need to be when they need to be?
You know, some people are always resistant to change and hesitant to try new things, right? I think that our data indicates that our service is working, and you're always going to have some outliers, and that doesn't mean that it's perfect, but you know, it looks like from the numbers we're getting that the average wait time is about 8.9 minutes. So about 9 minutes from when you request service, the average walking distance that we're seeing is 81 feet. So, I mean, you have to think about that. So you request a ride, and typically within 9 minutes, you have a micro showing up 81 feet from where you requested service. That sounds pretty good to me, Leslie.
And people have been getting error messages saying no cars available.
Yeah, so that is, you know, that's one of the things that we're working on. And one of the, you know, you asked what needs to be tweaked or what problems need to be resolved. And so we have some challenges around communication, and we are rewriting some of the code within the app to provide more detailed error messages than just that. We also need to communicate better to the stakeholders in the area that our service does not go into Park City, and we won't pick up and we won't drop off within Park City. And we're seeing a lot of requests for service in an area that we don't cover. And so our team has got a second round of kind of educational messaging and social media outreach to just communicate once again what our coverage area is. Hmm. So another challenge that we've had recently, which will be solved today, is that there's an electronic feed that goes to Google that helps people kind of hitch up with buses and plan their trips. We are going live with that today. I believe it's called a GTFS feed. And today that should be uploaded within to Google. And I think that will help a bit with people's trip planning.
So do we have enough drivers? Someone had posted a photo of the vans, six vans just parked, not being used. So if there's lots of demand, why aren't we?
Well, that's a great question, but you have to understand that that if we don't need the vans, then we're not going to be operating them, right? So if you look at our data, where our peak times are, and once again, this is all on our website. Our peak times are in the afternoon around 5 o'clock. So that criticism really is not fair if you're driving by at 5 in the morning or 11 o'clock at night when our utilization numbers are real low. So I think, and what's really interesting, quite frankly, is that we're 1 month into the service and people are, they're concerned that we don't have enough drivers. That to me feels like this is success.
Okay.
Right? I mean, we're busy. We're busy, and people are complaining that we don't have enough drivers. And we're 1 month in. That's pretty cool.
Are you getting feedback from the public, especially those people who were really upset that you had taken away the Silver Springs bus, the pink line, I think it was.
We get feedback. Generally, it's been positive. You know, we have had some complaints that we've looked into and resolved. We've had a few people in the community have really provided valuable feedback, like detailed feedback. Emails that we have taken very seriously and looked at their concerns, and it's helped us. You know, as I said a few months ago at a meeting, we need people to use our system. It's data driven. Our community's tech savvy. It's part of the reason why it's been adopted so well. Use our system. Let's learn, and we'll see what improvements we can make. You know, we've already made some adjustments. One of the things that we started initially was that we would pick up people at street corners or at nearby intersections. And one of the things that we learned through the data, especially in the rural communities like Upper Pine Brook or Upper Summit Park, is that there is no loss of efficiency if we pick up people at their residence. And so that is an adjustment that we made based on feedback and based on the data.
Okay, if people do have something to say, right there on the front page, it's hi@highvalleytransit.org. Somebody can send in an email with their...
Yes, or they can call us. There's also a phone number there. So you can call us, you can email us. And someone from the team will respond back to you. We also have board meetings every 2 weeks. They are in person now, which has been great. They're also online, and we have a public comment period. And we've had some recent public comments, which is great because we didn't have those early on. But you know, please feel free to attend our meetings and to provide feedback so we can act upon it.
All right. And then in terms of the route changes, are there going to need to be any tweaks to that? Or do you feel like what you've come up with is serving?
Well, we're, you know, the fixed routes has only been in operation a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. It's going to take about a month, maybe 2 months, for the data to kind of tell us what needs to be adjusted. You know, the plan for really the hub and spoke or the spine of the system, that's going to stay intact, but there might be some tweaks that we do with micro. There might be some tweaks that we do with maybe some of the circulators, but I think we have a good plan, and we just need to focus on being as efficient we can along that 224 corridor into the resort core.
Okay. And what kind of use are we seeing with the Camas line? Is that being used in the summer as much as it is in the winter?
So Annie, we don't have the exact numbers yet summarized, but anecdotally I'm hearing that 8 to 10 users in the morning. We think that will expand obviously as people get used to it and our system becomes fine tuned. We'd like to see more, but you know, we have to show our customers, our riders, that our service is just as good as what they're used to, and that they can depend upon it. And I think it will be adopted. I really do.
Well, I guess
I have real high hopes for the system, and I think that I think where we're headed is just it's really cool. It is.
Questions of that though, with not a lot of people using that Camas route, why are we using such the big buses? Why not just use some of the smaller transit buses?
So there's actually a story behind that. So those beautiful coaches that we have are being lent to us by the vendor that we've purchased our own coaches from. And so there's an operating cost, but that's not a capital expense for those beautiful white buses. We will, I think in mid-September, and we can check on that with Caroline and staff, but I think in mid-September, you'll see different equipment on that route.
Okay, and you've heard a lot of complaints about the fact that the buses are registered in New York, but we're hearing that that's going to be changed here.
Yeah, it's funny what people complain about, but yeah, the yellow plates do stand out on those black siennas, and it's my understanding that that those will be converted quickly to Utah plates. You know, I think there's a story behind everything, right? And 6 months ago, we had nothing, and we stood this thing up, which the community should be very proud of, but we stood this thing up in 6 months, and we took equipment from all over the United States in order to meet our kind of startup goals. And yeah, some equipment came from California, some equipment came from New York, but we're running, and people are using it. So I think if that's all they can complain about, then this is a win.
The transit building, what's the status of the plans for a transit building there on the Gilmore parcel?
So we have started, the county has started the master planning process on a campus. And a piece of that will be the bus depot or the transit facility. And I think, I know that there's, a meeting on Monday where a group of the executives at the Summit County are getting together to talk about that. You know, we've slowed the process down because I think we have a better understanding now, today, of what we need compared to what we did 2-3 months ago. So I think that Caroline and the team have engaged a new architecture planning firm that has extensive experience in maintenance facilities, shops, depots, and the process will start, but it's going to be a year, maybe 2 years before we have that facility completely constructed. And so we are looking at continuing to operate from the Ecker Hill facility through the winter. We're starting to winterize that lot, doing some things a little differently than we had anticipated, but the service is going to continue uninterrupted.
Okay, and then there was also a job description for an executive director. Isn't Caroline serving as executive director?
So she is in an interim role, and we are looking at making a permanent position there. And so we have crafted an outstanding job description, and we will be filling that position sometime between now and the end of the year. And Caroline is an outstanding candidate for that.
Okay. Joe, anything else you'd like to add?
No, I just would like to thank the community for their patience with us and encourage them to continue to use the services because it will help us get better. And I'd like to thank the fellow board members for the personal and professional education that I've gained over the past few months. And thank you, Leslie, for what you do.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks for your service.
Yeah, thank you.
New York City Council held a work session last night, as well as a public hearing on the proposed Gordo Soil Repository there off of State Route 248. In the studio now to update us on that and the rest of the council's business, Councilmember Max Dolny. Good morning, Max.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you seemed to be in favor of the project during the work session, saying it blew your mind that Park City would dump the soil in someone else's backyard. Yep, isn't that what the Tula site was designed for to do? I mean, it's basically in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, you know, I think we could take a step back and just think about how this was presented to us in the very beginning. When this first came to us, every single expert, every single study said that this was a very responsible soil mitigation effort. And it was, you know, one hydrogeologist even came to me at one of our Q&As and said, this is the best project he's ever seen in 30 years of consulting in Park City regarding soil mitigation. So when it first came to us, all five council members voted for this project. It seemed like a slam dunk. There were a whole lot of wins in there. We were going to save a bunch of money, which I know seems to be the thing that everybody kind of latched onto. But you know, that wasn't the primary factor. It was that we could take care of our own problem and we could do it safely, and it'll be safer than what we've been doing. And last night we heard from many community members, and quite frankly, it was pretty compelling. They had a couple points that hadn't really been brought up at the Q&A. One of them that I thought was, you know, particularly poignant was that Utah has kind of a long history of dealing with, you know, contaminated soils and toxic waste. And in fact, it advertised it by putting it on Energy Solutions Arena for a time, you know. And we as a community have never really trusted the state to do a really great job of these types of things. So I thought, God, it wouldn't it be nice if we could take care of our own problem for once? And so, you know, yeah, I was in favor of the project because it seemed to check a lot of boxes. But, you know, the community spoke loudly. We heard them. Once something gets labeled a toxic waste facility, nobody can ever get that out of their mind. And I totally understand that.
Yeah. So does that mean that the council's kind of backing off the plan, or?
Well, we're definitely taking a step back. I mean, we've heard the community loud and clear. We're going to look at all of our options. We had another commenter last night who came in and made it clear that we probably haven't explored all of our options in terms of dumping soils of this type. It's a super, super low toxicity level or super low contamination level. So there are some other sites around the state that might be cheaper for us to ship this soil to. And, you know, in all the years that I've been here, I've only heard about Tooele, and I, you know, I'll have to raise my hand and say, I made an assumption that that was the only site we could take it to, but it seems to me that, you know, maybe we need to relook at that and see if we can find a place that's going to be closer and a little bit more affordable for us to dump to.
Okay. One member of the public suggested putting this on the ballot. Any appetite from the council to do that? Or does it even possible since it's not a bonding issue?
Yeah, I honestly, Leslie, that's a little bit above my pay grade. I don't know exactly what it takes to get a ballot measure going. I think that we're listening to the community. We've heard them loud and clear. We're going to take a little step back and we're going to see if we can find some other solutions. But, you know, up front, this thing had, you know, social implications, economic implications, and environmental implications. I was seeing millions of miles of truckloads driving to Tooele thinking that's an environmental catastrophe. This stuff's going to get moved off of this site one way or the other. So half of the complaints that we hear, they're kind of moot points. This soil's going to move at some point anyway. It's been mitigated this way for my entire life, and we continue to get better at it. People just don't want it stored within our city boundaries, and I understand that. I throw my trash in the trash can, it disappears. I don't know where they take it. Somebody else came in last night and told us that some of our trash is going 90 miles away. So, you know, out of sight, out of mind seems to be the sentiment that we're hearing from the community. They do not want it here, and so we're going to try and look at other options right now.
Yeah. And what about the residents living in Prospect or looking to do landscaping or other yard work? That was one of the so-called benefits, having some kind of local depository for residents to take it to.
Yeah, very good point. That we don't have solutions for that right now. We don't have solutions for any of our soils. It's a, you know, other than shipping it to Tooele. And, you know, I wish that there was a better answer for you, but there just isn't. We have to, you know, in places like where you and I live, we have to mitigate our soils on site, right? So we have to either berm around our property or dig a hole double deep and pour our driveway over it or something like that. That's the option that we have. That's the affordable option that we have right now for residents.
Yeah. Would you be in favor of a smaller site then, just for residents to use? Or is that something that you don't think the community has
Look,
in favor of it as well?
it's really interesting coming in here and trying to be trying to represent the community, right? We get a lot of information from a lot of experts, and normally in my regular daily life, I take the expert opinion and I go, God, that makes a lot of sense. That person knows a lot more about this than I do, and I usually go with that, regardless of what my opinion on it. Opinions seem to have driven this into a different direction, and so we're going to have to go with what the community said. That's what we're elected to do, and I'm happy to do that.
So where do we go from here? You said we're going to step back. I mean, we're just going to look into
I think we're going to look at where we can haul it cheaper. I did not get the energy last night that any of these community members would be okay with this soil being stored within our city boundaries, even if, you know, I don't know, even if the most experienced person in the world came and said that this is perfectly safe, I just don't think anybody's going to be on board for that right now.
Okay, and at any cost then as well, getting it out of here.
That's what it seemed like last night. I did not see any cracks in the armor. I think council was looking at the expert opinions and going, God, this makes a lot of sense. We're going to save some money. We can store it. We can be really responsible about it. And the likelihood of failure and all these, you know, what ifs that everybody continues to ask are super duper low. But instead of that, it looks like we're going to have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how are we going to afford our affordable housing? How are we going to build these community centers that, you know, people have voted on? How are we going to fix our roads? I mean, we've got a lot of stuff that we need to do, and these soils they're going to be a problem for every single time a shovel goes in the ground. This is a problem for Park City.
Let's move on to deed-restricted housing. The council conducted a study session to explore whether the city could pay homeowners a percentage of their property's value as an incentive to require that who's ever living there to be called a full-time Park City resident through a deed restriction. This is called the Live Park City program. You said that you liked some of the ideas, defining a full-time resident as someone who works 30 hours a week in Park City, but would like to be a bit creative when defining what full-time means. So what are some of the details that you'd like to see fleshed out here?
Well, you know, I think the main point here, Leslie, is first, we live in a state where the state legislature really regulates us pretty heavily on, they don't allow us to regulate nightly rentals, so to speak. And so we're trying to come up with creative ways to build community in Park City so we have full-time residents. You know, the initial shot at it was if you work full-time in Park City, that would be one of the, you know, hurdles you'd have to get over. I think that might be a little bit of a stretch for some seniors who want to live here full-time, but they're done work, you know, they're not working full-time anymore. They're still a big part of our community. There are people that work remotely. We've seen a lot of that this year, obviously. Those are still wonderful community members. Some of my best friends don't work in Park City, but they would be considered lifelong locals, you know, and the heartbeat of our community. So we're trying to get creative with how to sort of assure that people are living here, but they're also participating in the community. And, my ideas were participating with some local nonprofits, the occasional volunteer thing, because we're not talking about small amounts of money. We're trying to get people over the hump on their down payment, which I think everybody knows is a really big hurdle for getting into a home or a condo in Park City, anywhere. And if we can get them over the hump and then we can, you know, commit them to living here and being part of our community, that's the goal.
So should we kind of flesh it out, though, with the legislature before we get too far along here?
Well, I mean, we've fleshed this out with the legislature a lot, and don't get me wrong, we will continue to work on this issue with the legislature, but they have made it very clear that they're not really interested in limiting nightly rentals. I think that's a huge lobby in this state, and they consider it kind of a small business option for people, and they don't want to take that away.
Yeah. I guess council was curious enough then to direct staff to do some more research, figure out what a budget would look like.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some other communities, you know, Vail is doing this, Breckenridge is doing a version of it. There are a handful of other mountain communities that are getting ready to implement programs like this. And I'm not sure that any one of them is fully baked. And so that's the idea is, you know, we want to take the bits and pieces from them and make it our own and see what we can come up with.
So the city, it sounds like, would pay the homeowner about 20% of the property value to put the deed restriction on? Is that how it's?
I think that's what it is. It's like 20% of the property value as a down payment so that it gets people into the home. And, you know, Vail's worked it all. They've been able to kind of work their system. They started at 20. They're down to 16, averaging about 16% of the home value. I forget the second part of your question there.
Well, it's just the deed restriction, I guess, and I just want to say would stay in place then with the forever, huh? It's in perpetuity?
Yeah, that's what I understand. But again, we are going, you know, we're still, it's in the baby stages. We're just trying to figure out what the program's going to look like.
Okay. And basically, I guess the payment up front, the 20% or whatever, is what? Payment for the loss on the resale value?
Well, I guess that's a good question. I think it's more of an incentive to get people to live here long term, and the deed restriction keeps them from renting it out nightly, right? So it's this incentive to build community.
Okay, let's turn to the Park Avenue project. A bit of discussion about the feedback that's been received for the new traffic pattern and bike lane there. What kind of feedback have you been getting?
It's been mixed, quite frankly. I have an employee lives over there, and he said, "God, my, you know, he actually lives in our affordable housing units over there," and he said, "I can't see the bikers riding up, you know, south, but up Park Ave." And then a lot of other people I've been talking to around the community, it took them a second to get used to. I think change is hard for almost everybody. The whole center line thing seemed to be a big conversation. But we haven't had any accidents. Traffic is slower. People are moving around town fluidly. We did put in a couple little dots around places where, you know, in the center of the road where the road jogs a little, so it kind of gives drivers a little bit more direction. And it seems the sentiment is turning. People are starting to like it.
Well, it is a pilot project. The street gets totally redone next year. Is that the thought, though? Is that we're going to move to that once the road's redone?
I mean, we certainly are focusing on trying to make our streets safer for pedestrians, for e-bike traffic, for bike traffic. This was a pilot project, and we're definitely still taking in that input, but it seems that the tide is turning from initial shock to, this seems to be working pretty well. They're used to driving a little closer to, what would it be, the east side of the road, because there's no parking on that side. So, I can't say for sure exactly how this is going to turn out, but it seems to be a successful project so far.
All right. And then the film studio, the owners of the film studio there at Quinn's Junction, are presenting a plan for more affordable housing units there than were originally approved. You seem to be pretty enthusiastic about the idea, but just worried at this point that the Planning Commission too busy to even have a look?
Yeah, you know, we've actually asked these guys to come back to council, and we can try and bake this a little bit further before we send it to Planning Commission. And, you know, our planning department is super stretched right now. Excuse me. Our Planning Commission have some huge projects in front of them, obviously, with the PEG project and Deer Valley. It looks like arts and culture might be paused for a minute at least, where, you know, they're not going to have to deal with that right away. But we don't want to stretch them too far. This is really, this developer came to us, and, you know, the film studio has been kind of a thorn in our side for a long time. We almost got forced into annexing that space just so we could have some control over how it looked. Here it comes back to us. We have a little bit of control over how it's going to look. And they came back with 100 affordable housing units. That's an immense amount of affordable housing for a developer to offer up out of the gate when they have zero responsibility to do so in its current state. So we have to take that very seriously. When they come to us and they say they want to help us build community, they looked at our Vision 2020, they tried to check as many boxes as they could, and they've responded every time we've asked them to come back with something new. They didn't just come back with, you know, a random red line. They went back and really did the work and came back with something substantially different, and it actually is pretty exciting. We could get 100 affordable housing units.
So what are you thinking, though, in terms of the timeline there?
Oh,
you'd be able to review it. I mean, is it going to be another year or so?
Yes, it could be a long, long process. And frankly, that's one of the pieces to this. The fact that they're willing to go through the process of amending an MPD or even reopening it, that's just a massive undertaking. Most developers are scared away just at the thought of it. So the fact that they're still coming back and wanting to do this, it speaks to their willingness to work.
Okay, anything else, Max?
I just want to remind people we're in election season, but we are a small town. Some of the soils conversation brought out a lot of emotion. The council really wants to put its time in and hear all sides of every issue, and we tend to come to the right conclusion at the end of the day. But there have been some pretty unsavory personal attacks online. I just like to see us get back to the small town that we are. We all know each other. We all have coffee together. We all go to the same concerts. Let's keep it civil. It's an election season. We want to elect the people we want. But come on, it's Park City. Let's keep it real here.
Okay. Max Donnelly, a member of the Park City Council. Thanks for your time. KPCW News Time now, 8:49. Good morning. Well, Better Boundaries of Utah has hired a new executive director. She's a name familiar to Summit County. Katie Wright, formerly serving as the director of the Park City Community Foundation. She and Jeff Wright, the chairman of Better Boundaries, join me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Leslie. Good to be here.
Yeah, Jeff, why don't we start with you? Just give us a bit of background on Better Boundaries. I mean, it was formed to be, a nonprofit, basically, to work with Proposition 4. Voters approved that in 2018. Then we got a compromise bill out of the state legislature.
It's been a long road, but we're here and we're finally in the process, which we're very excited about. And with the Utah Independent Redistricting Commission now meeting and engaging with the public, this is finally happening. And this is what we have been fighting for and advocating for a long time. And in addition to that, we're excited to have Katie now leading the organization. She was the clear choice to carry this organization forward. And I think she has the leadership and the ability to really make sure that we see through this process. We're a watchdog. We are going to monitor this process both before and after and lead us into the future. So we're very excited.
Yeah. So, I mean, does Better Boundaries still have, though, a job to do? I mean, hasn't the work been done?
Absolutely, we have a job to do. I mean, this is a process that is ongoing and continuing. And even after the Redistricting Commission has submitted its maps, I think that we have a process to make sure that this continues beyond this year. I think that we had a compromise with the legislature, and we want to hold them to that going forward.
All right. Katie, congratulations, and that was quick.
Thank you.
Did you think you're going to get a little bit more of a break? Or?
I had a nice 3 months of vacation, so I feel refreshed and very happy to dig into the work at Better Boundaries, especially on an issue as important and fundamental as redistricting.
Okay. So why was this something you wanted to do?
So redistricting is absolutely critical to have representation. You know, we all know the importance of voting, but once someone is elected, who are they representing? Is it a contiguous community? Is it a fractured community? It's very important that when someone has an issue that they care about, whether it's potholes or climate change, that they have a representative that is accountable to them. And the redistricting process, when done well, can improve accountability between politicians and voters.
Wow. We've had a super majority in the state as long as I've been here. Do you really think things are going to change?
Look, all important issues take incremental change over time, but I have found throughout my career that when you doggedly pursue something and you make those changes, when you look back over the course of 5 years or a decade, things have really improved. And so one of the goals of fair districts is to have less partisanship. And I think all of us can say that that would be a good thing in this day and age. Also, you have more action on issues. There's a lot that Americans are really united on, and I think it's frustrating when we see that those things don't move forward. Immigration reform, early childhood education. I mean, there's a lot of consensus around key issues, and when you have fairer districts, you have more active politicians, and the issues that we care about evolve, and I think that's something that every single Utahan would really benefit from.
Yeah. So as executive director, I mean, what is it that you'll be doing?
Yeah, so we have what I would say is a sprint to the finish line in the next 6 months. When the census data comes out all across the country, new districts are drawn. So one of our key roles is to really support the independent commission and ensure that that everything is implemented as planned. The second thing, and probably most important to all the listeners, is really to encourage participation. Participation is the most important thing at this point. So we want people drawing maps, submitting them to the independent commission, and really letting their legislators know that having independent redistricting is important. It's not an easy issue to explain, but when people stand up and say, we want a process that's transparent, we want a process that happens in sunlight, big things will happen. And we, as Better Boundaries, coordinate that effort across the entire state. So we have a busy 6 months of boots on the ground community organizing.
Yeah. What happened this week was that the Utah Independent Redistricting Commission launched a new website, and this, in fact, to allow people to participate firsthand in the process. How involved is Better Boundaries in that?
They launched their own website and are doing grassroots like engagement across the state. So look for their booths at various fairs and hopefully Park Silly. So we support that. We help give them technical expertise, but they're really the people that need to hear directly from citizens about what the map should look like.
Okay, but people can kind of go on. Have you been on to like
yes,
play around?
Yes, of course.
With
yeah, it's a great website. It's uirc.utah.gov, and there's a map drawing tool. There's also an excellent map drawing tool at our own website, betterboundaries.org. All of those are submitted to the commission. And it's a really fun process to go through, answer questions about what kind of community you want to live in, and actually draw a map that then engages in the process and is used, to make the final decisions.
Right. And again, we're expecting to get that census information next month?
Yes. August is the goal. And I heard from the Census Bureau just this week that it remains on track, hopefully. But it has been obviously a tough year with COVID-19 and the census.
Yeah, and again, this map is going to be line out the four congressional districts, our state Senate, our state House, and our state school board districts.
Yes, that is the process. So the commission is tasked with a majority agreement on three maps for each of those and bringing that to the legislators.
Okay. And I guess then back to the question. I mean, Jeff, given that you've been involved in this process since day one, given the fact that we have a supermajority in the Republicans, and that's how they've been able to do it because of the gerrymandering that's happened. How confident are you that we're going to get a map that feels like it is bipartisan and fair?
Well, Better Boundaries from the very beginning has been bipartisan, and it's wonderful to see the commission also be bipartisan. So our goal has never been an outcome. It has always been about a process, a transparent process, a fair process, an open process. So whatever the maps are going to be, they're going to be. And we want to see it be a transparent and open process and a bipartisan process. And I think that democracy takes work and democracy takes vigilance, and we're going to be here to be vigilant and to promote democracy as best we can.
So are we running out of time here? Because this needs to be submitted, my understanding, to the Utah legislature by November 1st.
So all across the country, time is condensed from the usual process. With that said, the commission is up operating. They have been meeting regularly. They have great leadership across the board. A lot of heavyweights across Utah history. So they're trusted people. So they will get the job done.
Okay. And again, we should start to see a lot of public input sessions or just ways for people to give the commission some idea of what map they like?
Absolutely, and we will keep you updated on those as they go through the fall. But right now, the most important call to action for everyone is to go online and draw your maps. So I recommend going to betterboundaries.org/draw. There's a great map-making tool there. And just start learning about the process, and then there will be other opportunities to attend meetings.
Again, it's uirc.utah.gov to go and draw that map. And then, Jeff, how is Better Boundaries getting funded?
We do fundraising. We do online asks. We have great supporters across the state and bipartisan, so we continue to do fundraising. I think with Katie here, we're going to look at the future and where we're going to go and what we're going to do. But we have great supporters, bipartisan.
Yeah, and so once we have these new maps in, is your job over or no?
I am on a six-month contract, but the organization sort of behind the organization is Utahns for Responsive Government, and I think that there are a lot of ways we could improve the responsiveness of our state, and you can see different democracy reform ideas and legislation across the nation, and so I think that is a question that we are exploring.
Yeah. Was that attractive to you, the six-month contract?
You know, I love the idea that I'm digging in and learning something new, but most importantly, working in a bipartisan effort for something that is so fundamental to change over time. So that's what I'm most excited about.
Okay. Jeff, anything else you'd like to...
It's critical that people give input. You know, Better Boundaries and its supporters have carried the water for many years now, and now it's time for the public to engage. And so we encourage and plead with the public to engage, to give input, especially diverse communities. We need to hear from the whole state. We need to hear from everybody in the state, and that's going to be critical to make this process work.
Okay. Jeff Wright? Katie Wright, you guys aren't related, right?
No relation.
Jeff Wright, Katie Wright, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.